We haven't entirely nailed down what element it is yet, but I'll tell you this, it's a lively one.
Let's give your parents a call right now.
Hello! Welcome to episode number 8 of Gaming with the Moms. My name is Nicole Tanner. I am managing editor at pixelkin.org and the mom of a 3-year-old. I am joined, as always, by fabulous fellow mom Linda Brenneman, beautiful Hi. And talented non-mom Simone de Rochefort. And I didn't mean to say that sarcastically, but that's how it came out. And our guest today is Matthew Johnson. He is an audio innovation director at Microsoft and also a dad. Thanks for being here.
Also not a mom.
Yes.
We love having the dads on.
But also beautiful and talented.
Of course. Yes.
That's how I look in the mirror every morning and say that to myself.
Nice.
With tears streaming down your cheeks. That's what I do. I cry and I say, you're so beautiful, Simone. You're so talented.
Okay, then. All right, so we're going to start things off with some news, the first of which being Simone was right.
I was right about Skylanders Superchargers. We heard this right before we came down to record the podcast.
Yeah.
So they did confirm that there will be vehicles in Skylanders Superchargers. Did you actually read about that, or is it
just
Simone was right?
I saw the headline that says Skylanders Superchargers adds vehicles to the mix, and I'm like, oh. I don't need to read anything else.
Yeah.
Simone
is right.
So moving on from that, sort of related to Skylanders a little bit, Disney announced Playmation, which is this really cool new tech thing that involves toys that you can like wear, and it makes you like get outside and reenact like, you know, battles between Iron Man and Ultratron or whatever his name is.
Did you even watch the Avengers?
I did not see the most recent movie. I have a 3-year-old. That's my excuse for everything.
These toys are really interesting. They have the ones I saw were basically they have an Iron Man arm gauntlet that makes all these noises. Like it'll make the charging up and firing the energy beam, whatever he does. I don't know exactly what substance Iron Man fires from his palms.
Yeah, and you're making fun of me.
Oh, hush. I watched a whole video about this. And then they also have Hulk hands, I think, that kids can wear. So basically the idea is that these are wearables, but for kids. And they have this whole kind of interactive storyline that you play out while wearing these toys, fighting against villains from the Marvel Superheroes universe. So this is pretty intense. I mean, to me, just thinking of the design challenges of building a wearable toy for a kid that won't be destroyed, that they can take outside, they could play inside or outside. They show them playing with these toys. So,
yeah,
I don't even know where to start with this.
Well, it says eventually there's going to be Star Wars stuff too.
Oh, yeah. Of course there will be.
So that's pretty awesome.
Did you guys watch the video?
I did.
I watched a little bit of it.
I watched it. It was so interesting how shooting-centric that video was. I'm kind of hoping that in the future, maybe when they do the Frozen one, they'll have other styles of play other than just shooting at things.
Yeah, I want to see casting magic spells as Elsa would be really cool to do.
Right.
So what they showed in the video was like the little girl wearing the Iron Man arm gauntlet and she's shooting at the enemy figurine, which is on this base. And I guess when eventually you do enough damage, the figurine will pop off the base and fall over and it's like, yay, you won.
They don't shoot at each other.
Kudos for having a girl in that video, though.
It was great, yeah.
It was really unclear to me, like, what the gameplay was.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I'm super interested in the idea, too, but I'm also, like, really hesitant to invest in a whole bunch of more plastic stuff that I have to either keep around or eventually throw into the landfill. And so I think the challenge for them right now, and obviously this is the first announcement, but the challenge for them right now is to just sort of, like, put the value proposition out there for parents especially. And one interesting thing too about like stuff for kids and when you're designing a game for kids is is understanding that the true customer is actually the parent. And one of the interesting things I did see in the video that I thought was like a little bit sort of a pause moment for me as a parent and as a consumer of many, many plastic game related items is that they're really noisy. And so one thing that I always did when I was making a game that I anticipated kids to be playing was I would always consider the passive participant in the experience. Mm-hmm. So like I always imagine like this is before even I had a kid, right? And I would imagine mom is in the kitchen or in the bedroom doing something else, and the kid is playing the game. And the kid is either and the game is making a lot of noise while the kid is playing it. Or my favorite example is when they push pause on the game and sort of walk away, and the pause music just keeps playing.
Oh my gosh! Oh. Yes.
So this, and I put myself in the mind of the mom, and I'm like, mom is thinking right now, I will never ever buy that game again, or I would never buy that franchise again, or whatever. Right. And so as you design something for kids, you think a lot about like, okay, what are the parents going to think about this? And what is their experience going to be as somebody who's not playing the game?
Yeah. Right.
And I thought those videos really showed a lot of noise coming out of the thing. And they're really irritating. Yeah. So I hope somehow there's like interesting enough gameplay to where that stuff just becomes less of an issue.
If there are actually game-like quests in the somehow, mm-hmm. they didn't really show how that works. But
it was very vague. It was a lot of kids, and I understand that for kids, I mean, their imaginations are so powerful. So they were running around and like dodging over beds and rolling behind cover and stuff. It's unclear how much of that is actually the child's imagination and how much of it is that strategic with regards to the game that they're playing. So we'll see.
But we can't forget about that market my brother and I had going when we both started having kids, was you give your nieces and nephews the noisiest toy you can at Christmas time. And then next year they get you back and give you even a noisier toy.
Well,
so
the question is, this was $117 to start with. Would that
No, that's too expensive. Yeah. That's too expensive for that.
Yeah, I don't know.
That don't really $117.
Oh yeah, my gosh. Which is for me a setback. Although I'm not a parent, so
no, that's a lot for a plastic toy. I mean, if it's not really that much more than a plastic ray gun that fits around your arm, then I don't know. I'd think twice about $117.
Well, you all mentioned the Skylanders, and I think like you know, there's Amiibo, there's the Disney stuff. What's it called?
Infinity
Disney stuff. And I think what's really interesting for me is because I have an 8-year-old who has this sort of insatiable appetite for those types of things, but then cruises through it really fast if it doesn't have like any depth to it.
Right.
You know, that there again is that passive experience that I have as a parent, as a consumer, where I'm just sort of like, hey, I bought that stuff and you don't play with it anymore. I'm just note to self, don't buy that stuff again.
Yeah.
It's interesting that so far, I mean, there isn't a lot of information about this new stuff yet, but even just the Skylanders, like, okay, you added vehicles. Like, I think I need more than that as a parent and as a consumer. I need to know more about gameplay, and I need to see that there is some sort of when I make an investment in this stuff, there's something behind it, and it's not just so that you can sell me more items, right?
So as a parent, do you think we're reaching a Skylanders bubble almost? I mean, it's been pretty big for a couple of years now. Do you think we're reaching a point where parents are going to be like, why is there another one? Why is there more stuff?
I can certainly just speak for myself as a consumer and just say, like, I stopped investing in that stuff when my son stopped using it, and that was quite a while ago, right? And we didn't go to the Infinity route. And, you know, I have to admit that I'm sort of like, when we're at the store or when we're having the conversation about like what this new stuff's coming out, and believe me, this conversation is had about every new thing that comes out. and it's really crazy how much, I know unboxing videos are really popular, but like he doesn't watch those, but he watches every sort of game related YouTube.
Right.
He watches the Nintendo Directs, he watches all that stuff. And so I often hear about these things from him first.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation with him, which he's getting really good at having with me, is like, okay, let's think about the stuff that we've bought like this before. Let's think about whether or not we still use that. Let's think about what we did with it when we were done with it. Like, what happens to this stuff? Does it just go away? Like, do we pass it on? Well, and that value proposition and that thinking is really factoring into his own process now. So now before he comes to me to start talking about whether or not we're going to get something, he's already thought through some of this stuff.
Nice. Wow.
And he often doesn't ask me about things because he's already thought through it and just kind of like goes, well, this is going to die in the vine, basically.
Wow. That's some good parenting on your part. Very good.
Very perceptive child too.
Yeah.
Awesome. So we'll see how the Playmation, it seems like Disney and Activision are kind of like, they just keep reaching and reaching and reaching. Prices have gotten more expensive and more expensive and more expensive. And I don't know. It seems like they're trying to just see where people's limit is as far as what they can charge.
About this to me, especially with the Marvel Disney stuff for Playmation, it's figurines that we already have for Disney Infinity, like Captain America. We already have a Captain America figurine, near field communications, smart toy, etc. They're making another one for another game. That seems to me like it's going to be a limitation. Then again, I had 10,000 horse figurines as a child. Yeah. That didn't stop me.
Yeah, but I had all the Care Bears too. So
nice. Yeah, I don't know. I want to be optimistic as usual, but this seems, it seems like they're experimenting, but it also seems like they're really saturating the market, especially when it comes to Marvel toys.
Yes. Well, from going to the Digital Kids conference last year, the smart toy thing is just huge. And the toy companies are all pushing that forward and trying to figure out what the next big smart toy thing is, the thing that combines computers and physical play. Because people are concerned about screen time and trying to get the kids away from a screen and out into the world more.
That's
and
good
so
point.
They're just trying all different things and seeing what sticks, I think.
Yeah.
In that context, this makes a lot of sense because there is no screen. It's just toy.
Yeah.
I like your question though. And I think maybe this is maybe for a future discussion or some of the ongoing thing that you guys touch on all the time, but it's like, at what point is that saturation point reached? And like, you know, is it just sort of like, are we going to be standing around and just being like, wait, I just bought a stick with a chip in it. and it's just like the stick without the chip in it, and I already had that stick. Like, I wonder when that's going to happen. Because to your earlier point as well, like some of these figurines or pieces of plastic, they really, when you're done kind of doing what they're designed to do, depending on how deeply they've been designed, they end up just kind of being like an action figure that has no use. Which is just sort of like the stick, right? It's, I mean, it could be a stick, and I could have just gotten a rock or painted a face on it and just been like, this is your new friend, pet rock.
And like, I love, as a kid, I loved action figures, dolls, I guess, or whatever. Not dolls, but figurines
you
of
still
Disney
love
characters.
Them, Simone,
it's
let's
true.
Be honest.
I still love figurines. But I would definitely have all these figurines of like dogs, rubber dogs, or whatever. And I would collect all the breeds and I would play these imaginary games with them. But again, we run into that problem of like, you don't want duplicates. You want to have a unique one of each one. So, I mean, that's where this, if Disney Infinity is already something that a lot of people have, I don't see parents really investing in another one that looks
Plus
to them to
more
be the same
expensive,
thing.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. What I wonder is, where is the smart toy market for lower income families who are seeing these huge starter packages like you have with Disney Infinity and with Playmation that cost, you know, upwards of $60 to $100 to get started with it. And, you know, it just keeps going from there. I feel like there is a market for lower income families with smart toys, but I don't know where that is yet. So that's what I'm interested in.
Hmm. Yeah. What about Amiibo? What do you guys think about that?
They're a lot less functional than the Skylanders Disney Infinity things.
Yeah.
Although we were just talking about this upstairs before we came down to record, is that we think that Nintendo is kind of holding out, and then when they release the next Pokemon, that's when it's really going to take off, and there will be one for each Pokemon, and
You know, that is a good point. I think that might be that, like, single collector aspect of it, where you want, like, one of each. That might do it, because the Amiibo, I think, definitely don't have a lot of function within Nintendo games. Like, they have function, but it's not very deep, meaningful interaction. But if you're collecting, like, every Pokemon that you have in your game, that could really be something, a small investment that pays off for a kid. Not for a parent who has to deal with hundreds of figurines. But,
Well, some parents buy hundreds of figurines for themselves, you know. It sort of comes, like, I have a ton of stuffed
Talking
animals.
Talking to future Simone.
That I bought, like, you know, 4 years ago, just before Anna was born. And, you know, it happens. Now I try to pass them on to her, but, you know.
I was joking about this with my friend the other day. I'm collecting these anime figurines, and we're joking, if I ever have a kid, Mommy, can I play with it? No, those are Mommy's figurines.
Yeah, I haven't gotten that way with
Don't
Anna
touch.
Yet. So, okay. So we were talking about lots of market type stuff. So this was an interesting story to me, because I buy crap loads of stuff off ThinkGeek. GameStop has bought ThinkGeek.
Woo.
I personally don't like giving money to GameStop because I think they make all their profit off used games, which can be a very splitting issue among developers.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so they bought ThinkGeek for a lot of money, and actually Hot Topic was trying to buy them too. And yeah. GameStop wanted ThinkGeek so bad that not only did they top Hot Topic's price, they also paid Hot Topic to stop going after this. So to me, this says GameStop is starting to realize we cannot sell box retail games for forever. So we have to have new ways to make money. That's just me, though. What do you guys think?
I haven't been in a shopping mall for, I think, like a decade.
Yeah.
Since I worked in one.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You're blessed.
But I think on one hand, like I really like, I live in West Seattle. I really like going to my local record store. And a big part of the reason why I live in that community is because there's a bunch of small independent retailers within walking distance of my house. And I have like ongoing relationships with these businesses, and I feel really good about patronizing them. And, you know, there's a gigantic local business that also sends things to you in the mail and via drone and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I certainly utilize that service as well. But I think when it comes to, you know, brick and mortar, I do feel like there's a service there and there's a role that those businesses play that you just don't get over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I got that from GameStop when I used to go there or whatever. Yeah. But I do think that I think about, you know, if everything's delivered digitally, which is certainly that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
I do wonder, like, is there a role or is there some sort of a business that supports that kind of community aspect of like going to, you know, there's a business here in Seattle called Pink Gorilla. And there was one in West Seattle. I mean, me and my son used to like have a great time on Saturdays going to Pink Gorilla, hanging out, playing the games, and the people who work there would just totally engage my son in all these conversations about stuff that I'm already tired of talking about.
Right. And can you explain for our non-Seattle listeners what Pink Gorilla?
Yeah, it's like a great little local game store that sells an amalgamation of vintage and current games, and they're knowledgeable. They have stuff in there that you can get your hands on, you can play. There's always like an NES or something up and running.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, you know, probably most towns have something like this, you know. And I think everybody can nod their head and go, oh, yeah, that place is really great to go into when I get in there, and it's awesome. But probably when I just need the latest copy of Game X, I probably just get it online, you know? Mm-hmm. And so as far as, like, an industry in a way that evolves, I think that, you know, big businesses especially tend to focus just on revenue and all these numbers. I think, like, for me, as a more of a designer and somebody who is less in the business realm, I think more about, like, what is the experience for the customer, and that experience needs to extend to, like, the experience that they have before they get the product, right? And, like, how they engage with the brand and how they engage with all the games that you work on. And I think those retail outlets are a huge part of that, right? And so those people that work in there, they're fans of your games, they're fans of the industry, and they're there, they're sort of evangelizing and advocating for the things that you do. And so I miss that. And I wish that I had like a really great, cool, independent game store in my neighborhood right next to my cool independent record store so that we can just go up there and get some records and get some games and have a great afternoon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's admirable, I think. But I think with ThinkGeek, I'm wondering if what they're really getting, what GameStop is getting, is that the licensing of the actual game characters, because, you know, you can't get something with Mario on your t-shirt unless you have a license, right?
Yeah.
And
ThinkGeek, Hot Topic, I think, has the Mario license. ThinkGeek has like Star Trek and some of the more like non-game geeky stuff. They do have Portal stuff on there, though.
Right. There is some game stuff.
There is some, yeah. Yeah.
But I'm wondering if that's kind of why they bought it, so they can get that licensed merchandise.
Maybe.
More.
Well, yeah, especially if they're looking at other properties that might not be licensed for clothing yet. And they can say, we have ThinkGeek, we have this whole market that we can sell it to. So give us this license. We deserve it. Or we can do something with it that's exciting. I'm glad that Hot Topic didn't get it, even GameStop, whatever. But Hot Topic has had issues with art theft before, stealing art from independent artists. So that's really scummy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just interesting. It's just really interesting to me. I think that this is the only time GameStop has bought anything that's not, you know, specifically game related. Right. Like, this is an apparel company, which makes me think they're really evaluating different revenue streams beyond selling just the games.
So have you all been in GameStop recently?
I know.
So is there a noticeable shift in the inventory? Are they taking on more and more physical products and non-game products?
I have no idea, but what it makes me think of is the fact that a lot of gaming news sites are also now doing just general entertainment news.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's a parallel there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, well, thinking they do offer a lot of headsets and accessories and now, you know, secondhand games and old consoles and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I think Geek, though, has always been online. Like, there's never been a brick and mortar version of it.
Right.
So it would be interesting to see if they start to put some of that stuff in their stores, for sure.
That's what it seems like to me. To me, it seems like they're looking for new inventory categories.
Yeah. Yeah.
And ThinkGeek has, and also ThinkGeek has done a really great job with actually executing on new product development. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
And they do it in an interesting way, which is that they gauge interest by making jokes about things.
Right. Yeah.
And then if it's popular as a joke, then they actually make it. Like, this is actually, people don't really give them enough credit for doing that. I think that's really interesting. And so, I think that's a valuable investment right there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I think, I'm sure it's partly the gift market. Like, as a parent who's gone into a GameStop looking for something to get my kid for Christmas, you know, looking for advice about that. If you've got other merchandise that you can also buy at that, you know, point of sale. Yeah.
Something that a parent would more readily understand without being engaged and like, what is this technology? What is this game?
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, oh, a Portal shirt. That I understand.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So moving along to next news. So Steam is now offering refunds for games that are purchased online. And this has sort of a double-edged sword here. It's great that consumers can get refunds for their games, like if they're broken or whatever. They couldn't really do that before. But some of the indie game developers who make short games, theoretically, someone could buy the game, play through the entire thing, and actually enjoy it, and then just return it to get a refund for it.
Yeah, that would be too bad.
Guarantee you, hopefully within the next week, they will, because what their policy is right now for refunds, and I'm not clear if it's active yet or if it's been proposed, but the policy is that if you've played like under 2 hours and decide you don't like it, you can get a refund. I guarantee you they're going to change it to something like if you've played less than 50% of the game, because they do have completion rates on or no, I guess they just have hours on Steam. I might be mixing that up with something else, but
I think the announcement talked about hours.
Yeah.
I'm certain that, I mean, lots of indie devs just talk about it.
Yeah. Hit Twitter and hit Facebook saying like, my game's only an hour and a half. Like,
yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
That's very unfair for small independent developers.
Yeah.
But that's a totally fixable problem.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
And I think the bigger, more important issue is that this is a really consumer-friendly move. Right. This is great. I mean, you're right. It's better for probably Valve and the consumer than it is for game developers.
Yeah.
But like in the short term, and if you're very short-sighted about it, maybe that's true. But in the long term, if you're a game developer, I think you have to be concerned about the health of the industry and about like a great consumer experience for everyone. And because then they're going to come back and they're going to buy more and more games, and that means you're going to sell more and more games.
Yes.
And so, you know, this is just something that every other retail outlet does. And the ones that do it really well, those are the ones that people go back to over and over again because they feel like they have a really great, respectful relationship with that retailer. And I think this is a great evolution for Steam and for just like it's a win for the consumer because the people who are going to try to cheat the system, they're it's a minority. I think most people are just going to be like, hey, You know, it broke or whatever.
Yeah. Or honestly, maybe not even have the energy to go through that refund process. I mean, so many customers or so many games that I've played where I've been like, ugh, that's whatever. But I don't have the time or energy to actually ask for a refund. So I bet a lot of people won't even take advantage of it. But it is nice to know that it is there. So,
yeah.
And to your point, too, like you're more compelled to buy things when you know you can return them. Hey. But what you're saying is, and then I might just be too lazy to actually return it. But the time that value proposition and that decision is important is when you buy it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
So some other news that is very relevant to parents. This isn't so much game related. So the Supreme Court was hearing a case about a guy who posted kind of really vicious threats to his ex-wife on Facebook. He was convicted for it, and then it made its way through the court system, you know, that blah, 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 appeals. So it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they threw out his conviction. And the reason that they said that is because the original jury was instructed to just base their decision on whether or not a reasonable person would find what he written a threat, which does not take into account his state of mind or mm-hmm. his intent. And that's what they said was wrong. But at the same time, they didn't really say anything about threats on Facebook and how you can prosecute them, which is kind of weird.
And one of the justices actually said, you know, this what happened here was wrong because it does not leave a blueprint for other courts to follow in future cases. It just leaves questions, and the Supreme Court isn't supposed to leave questions. They're supposed to answer
specifically
them.
That's Clarence Thomas that Simone was talking about. He said the Supreme Court's job is to decide questions, not create them.
I was almost right on with that.
Yeah,
wow.
You were. Facebook, you know, online bullying is a big problem mm-hmm. for lots of parents, and this just kind of
honestly,
who knows
the way that I see it, and I don't know why we don't treat it this way. If I am in another room of our office, for example, and I'm saying, oh my God, Nicole is the worst. I just want to, I don't know, insert violent threat here. I would never say that.
Yeah.
That would be
Really?
This is probably Courtney talking about me in the other room. But no, like someone overhearing that would be like, oh my God, what's wrong with this girl? There's clearly a problem between them. Like, why is she saying these horrible things about Nicole, who is an angel? And but if it's on Facebook, then it becomes almost a non-issue. Like, this is what I don't understand. Like, if you're saying that, it's you as a person saying those threats. It doesn't matter what medium you're saying them in. It doesn't matter, like, it matters who – that you have been like heard making threats. That's what matters.
And the guy actually said that writing this stuff out was therapeutic for him. And Simone and I were just talking about this upstairs. I'm like, if you need therapy, write your stuff down in a notebook. Like,
don't
scream it at your ex-wife on Facebook. You know, it's just
don't make a fake account and like actually make threats towards her.
I think I read up a little bit on this too, and there's a lawyer who has a blog at popehat.com who explained this pretty well. I think that this particular case is actually a lot narrower than it sounds. It was a problem with the jury instructions in this particular mm-hmm. case, and mm-hmm. so the case will be retried, and hopefully those substantive issues will be dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I just can't imagine there isn't going to be a huge groundswell after what people are going through with all these threats on Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. We just can't let this go on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it drives people out of their homes.
Yes.
People really are terrified. It's not fake. It's real. It's real scary stuff.
And presumably the people that are all terrified are reasonable people.
Yes, exactly.
Responding to threats.
I mean, when somebody threatens you with very specific bodily harm and then makes a YouTube video of himself coming at you with, you know, I don't know, weaponry or whatever, why can't we take that seriously as a mm-hmm. as a threat? I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to add to this, Matthew?
It just terrifies me too. And I think the problem that I have with it is just sort of, it's really hard to think through what a kind of practical, implementable, like, way to fix this. The solution is very, very elusive, right?
Yes.
And I think about, I mean, I've been bullied on the internet before, and I'm 44.
Yeah.
You know, it was some time ago. It was 10 years ago, but we were all adults, and people were just sort of, like, slandering me and making me feel really uncomfortable and threatening me and stuff. I think... And that really, like, infected my whole kind of way. I didn't get death threats, but it really affected me deeply for a long period of time. I think at some point everybody will be affected by this. And I don't know if that's the thing that tips it over the scales and gets people more taking it more seriously. But I think that what's interesting is you've got people now have the ability, every single person with a very low barrier of entry have the ability to get whatever hateful message they want out and directly to the person that they want to give it to. Used to be able to, like, you know, the classic case of, like, when I went home from school and told my mom I was being bullied, the thing my mom said to me every single time was, is like, avoid that person.
Yes.
Well, now you can't avoid them.
Yeah.
Right? It's really hard. And so it's like this sort of digital stalking pursuit piece of this is really concerning and hard to figure out how you get away from those types of people if you don't have a legal system to back you up so that you can actually say, like, hey, here's the threat. See, here's the threat. Yeah. Now do the thing that you do every time somebody brings the threat in.
Yes.
Like, can we put the law into effect now?
Yeah.
And I'm really curious about like where the legislation is that says, okay, if you get threat, you know, just pass through the gates. It's very pragmatic and very objective. It's like, boom, boom, boom. You do this, you do this, you do this. Death threat one, death threat two, death threat three. Then the police come to your house and then you get put away or you go to court or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I hope that's what happens. I hope they figure out procedures because we do know that certain kinds of threats are illegal.
Mm-hmm.
It's either illegal or not, and certain kinds of threats are illegal. But dealing with the anonymity and other factors that are happening just because it's on the internet.
It's impossible to have an online restraining order, basically.
Exactly, right. So I think those kind of things have to be dealt with and put into some kind of bureaucratic process that does get, you know, done every time someone runs into this, because if they don't start consistently enforcing the law on this, it's just going to continue.
The other thing that I'm noticing too is that the structural kind of power base is, I don't want to get it too, like, gender politically charged here, but we know who those people are. We know what the court system is comprised of. We know who politicians are, right? So the people who have the greatest potential to make a change here also probably don't value things like being driven out of the industry of choice as like a serious thing. It's like, oh, you don't want to be a game developer anymore because you're tired of getting death threats? Well, gee, I'm sorry, you have to find a new job. I'm not going to make a law for you, right? And I think, like, having, like, women driven out of the game industry because of something like this is it's awful, right? And so it's super serious, and it should be taken very, very seriously. And so I'm hoping, and I know this was brought up in a lot of the conversations, you know, a year ago, I'm hoping that something really, really terrible doesn't have to happen first before people start to take it seriously.
Yeah, we all do.
Yeah.
But it's a worry.
Yes. Yep. Okay, so we're not going to keep the whole show negative, I promise. We didn't bring Matthew on so that we could be negative about stuff. Matthew has been in the industry a very, very long time.
Well.
Oh, okay. I don't want to make you sound that old. Sorry.
Hello.
That's my job.
So, but he's worked at lots of places.
Yep.
For us as moms and women, PopCap. It's a pretty interesting place to have worked with. I'm sure anybody who listens to this has played a PopCap game. And if you haven't, then you've been living, I don't know, on a deserted island somewhere. So PopCap makes Plants vs. Zombies, Peggle, Bejeweled, like all kinds of great games. So what was it like to work at PopCap?
It was great. So I came from Microsoft Game Studios, where I had been for 10 years making things like simulations. Like, if you remember... probably don't. The early Microsoft game business was two or three simulators and like a collection of old school arcade games, you know, that all ran in Windows.
Flight Simulator, I remember.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Worked on several of those. And then, you know, the Xbox was born and a whole bunch of great console games came out of that. Still very, I mean, this is the console business of the 90s and early 2000s. Yes. Still very aimed at sort of the young teenage male audience.
Yeah.
And after 10 years of like hardcore simulations and then games for this sort of classic core gamer audience, I just felt like I wanted to, in one way, I wanted to broaden my own sort of career possibilities. Mm-hmm. But in the other way, I felt like, you know, I wanted to reach a bigger audience. I wanted to make games for people like my mom and for, and games that like, because I would always, you know, share my work with them, but they would just sort of try to be interested in it.
Oh, making games for your mom. Yeah. That's so nice.
It's so funny because, right, that's hilarious. But then that's what I ended up doing, right? So then I was doing my own thing for a while, and then I got tricked into a job interview at PopCap. And I literally went down there because a friend of mine was working there, and she said, like, oh, this place is great. You'll really like it, and you should just come and just visit. Yeah. And then they're like, hey, meet this person. I think I was wearing shorts, like surf shorts and a Slayer t-shirt.
And welcome to the game industry.
Yeah. And they're like, hey, meet this person. And then like, I was like, oh, that person's really cool. And I'm walking out, like thinking we're going to go to lunch, and they're like, hey, you should meet this person. And then I'm suddenly meeting like five people. and they offered me a really great opportunity because, I was audio director at Microsoft. And then, this person at PopCap was like, hey, I could see you being able to do everything that you do, but only in audio. You could just make an entire game. You have all the right skills. You have all the right sensibilities. Like, you could just come in and we'll start you off small, and then you can start working your way up as a game producer, and you can escape this audio thing that is, you know. And that was really what I wanted. I really wanted to just kind of grow. So I started out with like little Palm Pilot games and Hammerheads is one of their old games where you just, it's like whack-a-mole basically. And worked my way up. And one of those steps that I was kind of on the rungs on the ladder was the Clickwheel iPod. So it was just me and a programmer and an artist, and we made Peggle for the old Clickwheel iPod.
Nice.
And then the Clickwheel iPod turned into...
So you're responsible.
for more than you know. Yeah. And then the Clickwheel iPod turned into the iPod, right? Mm-hmm. With the actual touch iPod.
Yeah.
And then that turned into the iPhone, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And so suddenly I started out working on the things that nobody wanted to work on. And suddenly I'm working on we shipped the... Bejeweled 2 for the iPhone for launch of the App Store.
Huge.
And suddenly I'm working on this incredibly profitable cost center for the company, And that was it. Like, that was totally cool. And by the time I got to that point, and that was probably like a 3-year period of time, mobile was on fire. And the game industry, the casual game industry had shifted away from games that you play on the desktop on your PC into mobile devices and all these other portable things. And we were putting them on consoles and all this other stuff.
Yeah. So when you started on the Palm Pilot games, was there that feeling of these mobile games are going to get huge, or was it kind of just totally had no idea that it was going to blow up at that point?
We're going to put you on the stuff that no one's going to probably see. So if you mess it up, it's not a big deal.
And you ended up on a direct line to what is now mainstream gaming.
And all the moms in the world are playing them. My mom's playing them.
Well, right. And so suddenly, I have
80 years old.
Yeah. Right. And it's interesting because so then I'm in this environment now where women over the age of 35 were over more than the majority of the customers and the audience, which is a completely different thing to think about when you're making a game. I mean, and there's so many different so then you're not making games for women. You're just making games for everyone.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. And I think that is a really important distinction. And people mistake me when I say that stuff because I think they get the wrong idea. But anyway, so like great things would happen. We didn't really do a lot of focus group testing or play testing because we would just take the games home and just let our families play them.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Right. And you would get great, great feedback from just like people in your neighborhood or people at the bank or whatever, or your mom, right? And then, or your grandma. And then
you must have had a really great relationship with the people at your bank.
Yeah, well, yeah, some of them.
I'm just thinking, how many NDAs did you carrying around in your pocket at all times?
Well, you know, it was a lot easier back then because you just had the phone and stuff.
Yeah.
But, but then what was interesting, too, would be like for the first time, because, you know, I would go to a party or something, and if I ran into like a 16-year-old boy, they would be impressed with the fact that I worked on Fable or something.
Right.
But then now all of a sudden it's like, wait, you worked on Bejeweled? Like, I would be at the grocery store paying for food, and I would open my wallet up, and they would see the PopCap business card, and it would just be the checker on the other side of the other thing. And they'd be like, oh, you work at PopCap.
Yeah.
And then all these people are in line just like, oh, come on, man. Like, I want to buy this, you know. Right. I want to buy these apples, and you're like talking about games? What's going on? And then one of my favorite ones was like, I was getting my blood drawn and I'm sitting there and I'm getting my blood drawn and she's just like, so what do you do? I'm like, oh, I work on games. And where do you work? With PopCap. Oh, PopCap. Oh, I love PopCap. And she starts talking about Bejeweled and she's like trying to get secret information out of me. Like, 'cause it was when we had the leaderboard on Blitz. And so
she's like,
you know, my mom keeps beating me and how do I beat her? And I think she's paying for boosts and I think that's how she's doing it. Like, is it true? Can you pay more and win? And like, she's just trying to get all this information out of me. And I look at her and I'm like, is that enough blood? And she's like, right? Oh my God. And she like was taking way too much blood.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. The dark side of casual games.
Yes. Totally.
Wow.
I'm like, that's amazing. I'm turning white.
Yeah. So one of the cool things that you did at PopCap was you started the Fourth and Battery division. I don't know if division is the right word for it.
Experiment.
Yep. Yes. With some totally awesome games came out of that experiment. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I co-conspired with a person by the name of Jeff Green, who was like head of kind of community, and he was doing a lot of PR and stuff for PopCap at the time.
Oh, Jeff. CG Computer Gaming World.
Yep.
Jeff. Oh.
Everybody knows Jeff Green.
Yeah.
You walk around with Jeff Green and then you become totally unimportant because everybody loves Jeff Green. A little jealousy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Just a little.
No. So Jeff and I kind of got behind this idea. It was seeded to us by a sort of senior management in the company who was also really cool and like thought this might be a really great way. I mean, really it started me and this person sitting in their office talking about sort of some of the problems, not problems, but just like challenges that PopCap was facing at the time. And a lot of those challenges were like retention, how you keep people around and happy in a situation where you have to work longer and longer on a core franchise, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're having great success, but like, you know, new IP at PopCap didn't come around every day. And so so while you're looking for that next great game and you're working on Bejeweled 11 or whatever, you know, how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep, and you want those creative juices to keep flowing because as long as that's happening, even if you're working on Bejeweled 11, you're going to have great new ideas for Bejeweled 11 as long as you're like inspired, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we thought, well, we could come up with a program that would, get people into a quicker iteration cycle too. Like games are taking longer and longer and longer than we were used to them taking. Mm-hmm. And so let's like train muscle memory and get people used to working faster and iterating faster and throwing things out faster. Let's make it fun so people have a reason to stick around and be engaged and be interested. And then let's look for a new talent within the company. Mm-hmm. So like maybe there's some secret talent hidden in accounting or hidden in like HR or whatever. Like how would we find that? So we put this thing together where it was called Pop Camp. And it was like a week where we would take the entire studio offline and we would have like this big game jam, right? Mm-hmm. And people would just kind of, there was a little bit of a green light process where you had to pitch your idea and you had to build your team organically and walk around and say like, I need a producer, I need an artist or whatever. And this was a great time for somebody in accounting to say like, I always wanted to try being a producer. Can I be the producer on your project? Mm-hmm. And so they would assemble these teams and they would have a week to work on their game. And then at the end, there would be like a little kind of a game party where everybody would bring their games and we would play each other's games and, oh, this is great. And it was super fun, and we just get pizza, and it was great. So we did that, a game came out of one of those called Unpleasant Horse.
Yes.
And And there were issues, right? It was like, this game is not the typical PopCap game. There's like a little horse that gets, if you fail, it goes into these meat grinders.
Yes.
And we don't want like, we don't want the bejeweled audience to accidentally get a hold of this and show it to their kids. Like, how do we deal with this? Well, let's come up with our own little label that we'll put on it. And so it's just sort of like this organic kind of thing that started to grow and grow and grow. And so I have two really great sort of anecdotes that came out of this. We only released three games. We released Unpleasant Horse, we released Candy Train, and we released Allied Star Police. And so what was interesting was that for Candy Train was a game that was on our website for a long time, and we took it down, and people were pretty vocal about the disappearance of Candy Train. And which is funny because it's a small little game and you're just sort of like keeping the train on the tracks. And
very challenging, though. That's what keeps you coming back. It's very challenging.
You were on there, right?
Yeah.
What did you do with Candy Train?
My daughter has tried to play Candy Train and I'm just like, no, honey.
You're not ready for that yet.
She doesn't really care, though. She just like switching the train tracks and like the train crashes and that's funny. So
Yeah. That's colorful and it makes sense. So, this a woman who was working in this relatively like, you know, sort of utilitarian part of the company. She was building DRM wrappers for our PC games.
Yeah,
and she had been trying.
Definition required.
Yes.
Oh, it's digital rights management. So soft copy protection.
Okay. Yes.
The thing that everybody loves.
And what was the other acronym? DRM for what?
For the computer games?
PC games? Yeah. So, personal computer.
No, you used another acronym. I am the acronym police.
I don't like them either. I don't like them. Please catch me. Okay. I appreciate that. So then, she was like, hey, she came to me and she said, because she had been trying to get into the game studio and it was sort of a boys club and she had been getting all these kind of BS responses. You want me to elaborate on that one?
No, that was okay.
So anyway, she was like, "Can I take Candy Train?" And her boyfriend at the time was in QA. It was a tester. Mm-hmm. And
QA stands for quality assurance.
QA stands for tester. And so he wants to be a producer. So he'll be the producer. And then I'm going to take this web game and I'm going to make it into an iOS game. Mm. Is that okay? Like, will Fourth and Battery basically like sanction and be the jumping off point for this? And I was like, absolutely. This is great. This is a great idea. We need it. We need another game. This is totally great. This is exactly what this is for. So, you know, it took a while, like it took like 3 or 4 months and they were doing it at nights and weekends on their own time. It wasn't interfering with their day jobs. And I was just getting them resources and I was really like not involved other than just being like a cheerleader. Mm-hmm. And if they needed something, then I would get it for them. And there were a couple occasions where like they just needed me to tell their boss, like, can you just give them like a day, you know, can you let them take Friday to just do this or something like that? Mm-hmm. It was really, really not much. And then, so they power through it, and they finished it, and we got it into QA and everything like that, and we released it under Fourth and Battery.
Yeah,
and it was a huge success. And the day that the game came out, I hope it's okay that I use her first name anyway. Sophia was standing at my desk, and she was just like kind of like bouncing up and down, but crying and just like so happy that this had happened and that this game had come out. And that for me was just like complete validation for this thing. I was just like, this is exactly why I put any effort into this whatsoever.
That's so good.
And then she ended up getting a job in the game studio as a result. They're like, oh, well, you obviously earned your way and you did this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so check, right? It was like a way for somebody to elevate their own game by making a game. And I thought that was awesome. And then the other one, which is a shorter story though, is just that we got a call from the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and they said we have a kid and he wants to make a game and he's been turned down by all the other area game companies, and I was just like, well, that's great, because if they hadn't turned him down, then he wouldn't be standing here with us right now,
right?
Like,
yeah.
This is awesome. This is perfect. So we brought him in. His name is Owen Weinert, and he came in and he I sort of set up this sort of like game development theater where I got like all of this sort of PopCap chiefs to sit around a big giant table, and he was going to come in and he was going to give us a presentation, and I was expecting to have to basically like prop him up and crutch him through this whole experience. Uh-huh. And you know, he comes in and he just basically shut down the entire room with like this amazing presentation.
Wow.
And answered all the questions, soup to nuts, had the whole thing figured out.
Wow.
But was really succinct about it. It didn't take him very long. And he was just like, bam, 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 this is the game I want to make.
Was this something he had worked on with you before? Or just
nope.
He worked on this on his own?
Absolutely, all
wow.
by himself.
Wow.
Came in, totally knocked it out. People were just kind of stunned.
Yeah.
And then we of course, greenlit the project.
Yeah.
Worked with him for a couple months. It was the longest time period that we ever worked on a Fourth and Battery game. Mm-hmm. And we released the game and while we were working with them, he was just sort of so great to work with and so, totally, present, but not only that, he knew what he was doing. And it was like this innate thing for him. Like he just very, very like without even thinking about it, he was like, look, those characters, they're in space. You need to put helmets on them. Like there's no atmosphere, you know, like oh, almost yeah. like. Dummies, you know, like, and it was nice. So we're like, oh, of course, right? So,
yeah.
Thank you. So, he was doing the job that many of us have like strived to do well for
wow.
very many years in our careers. He was doing it really well right out of the gate. We made this game and we threw a party for him, and he brought all his friends. We got a limo and some pizzas, and he brought all his
nice.
Friends in, and he sat down for the first time to play the finished game. And I was very interested in this moment because this is like kind of the proof of whether or not we did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Like if he sits down and plays the game and I see in his eyes, like, you know, he's
right.
he's good. He's a good kid. He wouldn't probably punk us out or say it wasn't good, but I can tell. Right.
Yeah.
And he sits there and he's playing the game. And the best sort of validation of what we had done was that he went through the whole game, sat down, he played through the whole game and won it his first time. And was just like, that's exactly what I expected, right?
Nice.
And so,
nice.
So it was great. And his parents were telling us the whole time, you know, like, he's going through a really hard time. His treatments aren't very, he's really uncomfortable mm-hmm. all the time mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But he's like, this is the thing. This is the only time we see him smiling. And so
wow.
that was really great. And another really awesome byproduct
yeah.
of this program that I think, and then, Once we had done it for a while, we were getting calls from Blizzard. We were getting calls from all of these other game companies mm-hmm. saying, like, how did you do this? What can you tell us about this program?
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to hear stories about other people instituting similar things.
Wow.
Yeah. Hearthstone actually came from a very small team within Blizzard.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I love Hearthstone.
It's a good game.
Yeah.
Does PopCap still do that? Do you know?
Nope.
Unfortunate.
Oh, too bad. But now you're going to have Microsoft do it, right?
It's a good legacy.
It's funny because the concept has sort of permeated the industry,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like kind of like my work is done here.
Yeah.
like people do it. I think there's definitely room for more of it. And I think that what's interesting to me is that the idea of sort of a cultural people talk about organizational development. Mm-hmm. A lot, but they never really talk about it from the aspect of like how you develop the culture of that organization,
right.
How you make that culture healthy, and how important a healthy culture is to the overall health of your company.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what was interesting is that there were many times, and there still are conversations about this when you talk to people who were around at that time. There's, you know, not everybody thought it was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody thought Fourth and Battery
yeah.
was awesome. Like,
yeah.
imagine if you're the person who's looking at the ledger and you're like, you're going to take the entire game studio offline for an entire week.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
super expensive.
Yeah. How many man hours is that?
Right. And yeah. and you're also, you're going to like, the whole point of this is that you want to take my like critical path, superstar developer person on this game that generates all this revenue, and you want to put them on this untested idea that we don't even know is going to
yeah.
go anywhere.
Right. Yeah.
So, I understand all that,
yeah.
But I think that the what we proved with Fourth and Battery, and unfortunately some people still don't get it, is that if you invest in your culture in that way, and it doesn't have to be exactly in that way, it could be in mm-hmm. another way, but
yeah.
but if you look at those same sort of values and you invest in those values, the everything else will come along with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think there's a lot of value also in, for creative people, taking all the limits off and giving them that short amount of time to just do something completely off the cuff that is just purely whatever their vision is, without thinking of all the planning that has to go into creating a product that really needs to be solid, that needs to be marketable, that needs to like go out the door. There's like, I mean, that's the concept behind National Novel Writing Month, is you sit down and you write this book. You don't worry about making mistakes. You just put something out there, because writing is practice. Yes. And I think it's the same with game design, where as long as you're doing it and practicing, and maybe you just for that week get rid of the fear of trying something new and trying something risky, you can create something really good. You can also create a mess, but, you know, you're still learning something.
Definitely. I did NaNoWriMo. Yeah. Well, I've tried to do it many times, but I actually completed it once, and it was like the best feeling in the world.
It feels really good.
That I was able to accomplish that.
I think you see some of the most successful game companies too, like Valve, or companies in general, like Penny Arcade, will have an atmosphere like that, where you feel like they really do take the time to let people be creative
and make mistakes.
Try different ways of working together. And but good for you for doing it first.
Yeah, seriously.
Well, I don't know if it was first. And one other really sort of important point too that you all just made me think about is when you disconnect that activity, that creative activity, from the revenue potential question, then you do free up a lot.
Yeah,
like, because it is a business. And this is the thing that, as somebody who was sort of riding on the kind of leadership side of this Fourth and Battery program, it was like I had to definitely placate the side of the argument and the side of the company that was like, hey, we're still running a business here.
Yeah.
Because I understand that, and I totally I agree. Mm. Like, you can't do this cultural development stuff to the detriment of your bottom line.
Yeah. Right.
Right? It has to be affordable. And the value needs to be realized in some way. It can't just be this soft value that you have to just hope is there, or that you, if you close your eyes and like say om three times, it emerges. But so it's difficult, and there's a reality to it. But if you can somehow isolate your culture for a minute from the need to make money, they will, the flavor of creativity changes drastically.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Absolutely. These have been great stories. Yeah. So we know Matthew makes games. What have you been playing recently?
Okay. So I ride the Microsoft corporate transport for an hour or hours a day. Yes.
I've definitely heard of the Microsoft corporate transport.
Yeah, wonderful. It's wonderful. It's a lifesaver. But so I spent a lot of time on my 3DS.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And I've been, you know, it's weird. So when the 3DS first came out, I was the most excited about the NFC Street Pass stuff.
Mm.
To me, that was like the innovative feature. I didn't care about the 3D. I didn't care about anything else. I was just like, wait, if I'm walking around and I walk near somebody, then we exchange information. And then later it's like a little gift. Like, I open it up and I say, oh, there's people in there. And
yeah.
Like So that was really exciting to me in a way that made me feel weird, because nobody else cared for like a long time.
Yeah.
And what's even weirder is it's still totally like the primary activity for me on my 3DS. Mm. So like, I play those games, that those Street Pass games in the Mii Plaza all the time, and there's no reason for me to be still playing them. But I'm like, well, I have 10 Street Passes, and I have to go through this process. And they finally came up with a way to kind of stash the games that you've already played and just kind of put them in a folder, basically. And so I just started doing that. But so anyway, I spent a lot of time playing those pointless games that give me hats.
Yes.
What about you guys?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. What have I been playing lately? Okay, last week I played Life is Strange.
Your cat game.
The cat game.
Where you get free stuff as well.
It's all Hearthstone and the cat game. I didn't play much except for Peggle. Thank you very much. It's been a week and a half of living. So I did buy some plants, though. I did some gardening in real life. So That's wow. Cool. We could call it Plants vs. Zombies, where I'm the zombie.
You know, there's a, yeah. there's a Flower Town is one of the games on the street pass. So you grow flowers.
Oh, so don't get her started. No.
I want a 3DS just so that when I'm at conventions, I can open it up and be like, hundreds of street passes.
Yeah.
Score.
Yeah, so I've actually played more than Hearthstone this week. I know it's a shocker for everybody. I played some more Dragon Age Inquisition because I have, you know, Monday is my free day when my daughter is not with me and I'm not working. So yeah, I've just gotten just past the point where the world basically opens up when you've gone through like the required nice. Quest things, and then you've got all these places that you can go. So
too many places.
Yeah, but what I like about this one is that, you know, it lists all the places on the in the journal screen, and you can just toggle them off or on, and it shows you all the quests in each place. So it's really easy to know whether or not you've done everything.
Yeah.
So, which makes it – I know the first Dragon Age, my husband, like, he still talks about this. It was like – there was some side quests in this one town, and he was like, oh, okay, I'll do that later. And so he left and went. And then the town, like, gets destroyed before you have a chance to go back and do that. Yeah, I don't remember what the name of the town was. But, yeah, that definitely happened to him, and he's just like, what?
That's always the danger in games.
Yeah.
I find that so funny. Every time you boot up a game, it's like, oh, God, please don't let me go the right way at first.
Yeah.
I want to go the wrong way. I want to finish everything else, and then I'll move on the right way.
Yeah. So that's where I am right now. But, like, I've just started playing. Usually I find that my patience just goes out the window, and I'm like, okay, I just need to finish this thing already. And then, but I also played and finished Device 6, which is a Sumogo game.
Awesome.
I don't even know how to describe it.
You finished that?
Don't describe it. Yeah. I've heard that you shouldn't describe it because of spoilers.
Well, I mean, genre-wise, it's really hard to classify. It's sort of point-and-click adventure. It's sort of interactive novel. It's got a lot of weird things going on for it. But it was really, really cool.
Yeah.
The puzzles were really fun to figure out and solve, which can't be said for a lot of those types of games. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
Sumogo is a very cool – they're a Swedish developer, and they've just done some amazing things with mobile games. They did The Sailor's Dream, which Courtney absolutely loves, and I think you loved it too.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's a great game.
Yeah.
And Device 6 and
– Your Walk.
Your Walk.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, Courtney's been a fangirl of theirs
for
a while, but I am now too. Like, I can't wait to see what they do next because their stuff is so creative and just really, really cool.
Yeah.
So, Linda, your turn.
I went out and bought myself an iPad.
Hey.
I've always been a very Microsoft-centric person.
Which is not why Matthew is on today, by the way.
No.
When does our check from Microsoft get here?
Yeah. That might be I have like $5.
Let me be clear. That was a joke. Yeah. It was a joke.
I love Microsoft. Microsoft's been good to me. And I have my Xbox and all that stuff. And I've had a little trouble kind of relating to Apple products maybe over the years. But I bought an iPad and it's great.
I love the iPad. It's a wonderful.
Yeah, you can't say too many bad things about the iPad. So I downloaded Revolution 60.
Nice. Cool.
And I've been playing that. That's really fun. And interesting. It's the it's an adventure game, sort of
role playing
game with
all female characters.
Yeah. Right.
My favorite thing about Revolution 60 is just the combat system. I've never had a combat system that feels so good on a touchscreen before.
It's awesome. You can tell that they totally made it just for mobile.
Yeah,
like, it totally works that way. And even though it's out on PC now too, but.
Yeah, well, she's putting it out on PC.
Yes.
It has not come out yet.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's interesting the different varieties of attacks and things.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Turns it into a rhythm game, but not quite.
Yeah. That's one of the things that was most impressive to me was that combat system.
Yeah.
For sure, which was really cool.
And I tried to play a little Hearthstone. I played against the
computer.
The computer. Yeah. I won 2 games.
Yay!
And then the third one, I was like, "What? I don't even know what I'm doing here. I need that tutorial that you promised me."
Yeah, I found that too.
There's cards. You play them. Stuff happens. I don't know.
That's kind of the game.
Yeah.
You nailed it. That's it.
I can't tell what I need to do to make things come out the way I want them to come out.
Yeah, that's the way I was too at first. It's like I never played like Magic or anything like that. So I really wasn't familiar with the whole card game battling type thing. But like,
takes a while.
It was fun enough that I stuck with it. Like, yeah. I was really enjoying it. And a lot of that has to do with the UI. Like you were saying,
the graphics.
It's really kind of really cool to like throw your minion and they slam down on the field. And yeah, it's super cool.
With those tutorial matches, there were definitely like I would hit a wall and then I'd go away for a while. But every time I came back, it'd be like, oh, it all opens up for me now. I see the truth. I see the way I have to go. So
you have to have faith.
And there's even, you know, there's still, even you could be the most skilled person with the best deck, but there's still a little bit of chance in there because you're not always going to get the right cards at the right time in your draw. So
it breaks all the conventional rules of sort of like bringing people in the easy way and like letting people win over and over again. This is sort of the casual game, you know, methodology for building a broad audience, especially when it's free to play. You want to have like as many people playing as possible and get them engaged and then start to make it harder and not have too many barriers of entry. I think what's interesting about Hearthstone is that, you know, I totally lost like my first few games and I was sort of defeated and not feeling super great about it. And then I just pushed through that. And it's weird because then that experience actually was the right one for that game. Like I needed to lose a bunch of times. And what's interesting too is that every time an expansion comes out, it's the same thing again. It's like I lose a bunch. I feel like I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, and with these new cards, like you try to throw them in your deck and you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the kind of hard, not necessarily hard, but the tutorial kind of being like completely brutal, in so to speak, on you, prepares you for ranked mode. Like, absolutely prepares you for what it's like to play against other Hearthstone players. So it's completely necessary to do that. All right.
And that'll be the end of our Hearthstone conversation.
Yes, we won't go on for 15 minutes like we did last week, which you didn't hear because we cut it. But we'll be talking about it when we do a Let's Play.
Because I told Simone to cut it.
Yeah. So last week, I apologize. Chuck V sent us a letter and I forgot to print it out and read it. I forgot to print it out this week too, but Courtney, bless your heart, printed it for me and ran it down here. So Chuck V wrote to us and he said he's recently purchased the Counting Kingdom, which is a game that we love, for his daughter.
Fun trivia about that. Math. Jenna Hofstein, who made the Counting Kingdom, did the combat system for Revolution 60.
Oh, I knew her name sound familiar. She's going to be on a she's going to be a guest on here in a few weeks, so we're really excited to be talking about that. So the question that Chuck had is, he said he was wondering if we had any other games to recommend that could help children learn different topics such as language, music, etc. We were talking about this a little bit on the podcast where Curtis was. There's a really cool game coming out that I'm super excited to try. It's called Ever Jane. It is an MMO set in the world of Jane Austen, where you you're kind of cooperatively with like another person, you sort of act out these scripts. So, you know, you're given a setup, like you're two people in love and you have to try to keep it from your parents, or, you know, that type of thing. So it sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to playing that. But
sort of like users creating their own stories as they go through the game.
Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine that that will make the reading of Jane Austen novels in high school a little more palatable to most people. So Matthew, do you have any suggestions in that realm?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Like, do you interpret the question as like a game that teaches kids about the subject matter, or actually, because music is something that is very, very it's a big part of my household. And when my son Hank was very, very young, we still had all the plastic instruments out.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know, he was probably 4 when he could get 90% on medium in Rock Band on drums on like –
that's impressive.
Deep Purple Highway Star, you know.
Wow.
And what was crazy was that, you know, I would just come down there and he figured out the menu and he could find the songs. He'd boo, 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 boo. And I would just hear like, ka-ching, that UI, ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. And it, ka-ching, ka-ching. Yeah, yeah. And so he was down there and he would just play through these songs. So he was getting exposed to the music. He was listening to this music over and over again. He was also kind of like dissecting the anatomy of music through the different sort of notes and how they, and he was sort of, it's basically sight reading.
Yeah.
Yes. It's the same skill set that you use when you're sight reading, but you look ahead and sort of anticipate it coming, and then you have to hit it at the time. And then what was interesting too was that like it transitioned really nicely into an actual drum kit, which we already had.
Yeah.
And so he could just basically just start playing drums. He had all the muscle memory and everything.
Yeah,
like that.
That's awesome.
So,
very cool.
Yeah, Rock Band has had an effect like that on me too, even as an adult. Like if I hear a song on the radio, I played the bass part in Rock Band. I can pick out the bass part now, which is something I never could have been able to do before. So
that
yeah,
awesome.
Rock Band is awesome.
Yeah. Isn't there a new music game coming out?
There's a new Rock Band coming out.
New Rock Band, right.
Which is going to be awesome because it's going to be backwards compatible with all your DLC. And my husband and I bought a lot of DLC for that game.
Yeah.
So we're super excited about that. There's going to be another Guitar Hero, too.
Oh, good.
So the wave of the plastic instruments is coming back.
Yes. And I remember, Simone, you did a post for Pixelkin on rhythm games.
Rhythm games. Yeah, there are definitely a few that I really like. Crypt of the Necrodancer is one that we've talked about. And actually, we have a indie pick of the week video up about that right now. Yeah. And you can use your own music in that, and it's basically a dungeon crawler but set to a rhythm, and you can also hook a dance pad up to it, and
super cool,
which I did at PAX a couple of years ago, I guess. And so you know, you're just trying to like hit the combos with your feet and attack the dungeon crawly monsters, and that was a lot of fun.
And the monsters like kind of dance the music. Like they've got these like things where they
the floor looks like a disco floor, like with the lights, squares lighting up and then not lighting up. It's
super cool.
A lot of fun.
We'll put a bunch of links in the post for the podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
When it comes to language, I like Duolingo a lot. Courtney's been doing the Swedish lessons, and I guess she has encountered like a few incorrect things in that, but when I was
it to Courtney.
I know. Perfectionist Courtney. I was brushing up on my French with Duolingo, and I found it to be pretty adequate. I think it's hard to start, though, because it's very much it's based on memorization, first of all, but then also it doesn't really tell you what you're doing wrong. It has you, like, dragging words to form a sentence, which I like a lot for reviewing. And right now they have a lot of mostly they focus on European languages. I think they have French, Spanish, Italian, German, and Swedish. They actually have a lot more languages if you're like coming from not being an English speaker. Like they have English for Vietnamese speakers. They have Italian for Vietnamese speakers, things like that, which I think is really interesting.
So the other thing, I don't know how old his daughters are, but actually the Endless Alphabet, Endless Reader games, good for teaching letter recognition and phonics and actually I think helping in reading a little bit. But they have Endless Spanish out now. So it's the same deal as Endless Reader except for it's Spanish, which also makes me wonder how many more languages they've got up their sleeve that they can do this for.
A lot. I mean, that's the time to start learning a language.
Exactly.
When you're super young.
Right. Yeah. So so I think that might be a cool one too. If your daughters are too old for that, just disregard that.
Now, how does it with the Spanish, does it like give her the English equivalent and the Spanish equivalent? Or
yes,
is it just
there are two options. You can do full immersion where you just get the Spanish, or you can get the Spanish with the English translation.
Okay.
So it'll say the word and then it'll say the English translation
that is so
for
cool.
you. Yes.
Nice.
It's very cool.
And you spell the word.
Right? Yes. Well, you start like the word is on your screen. Lots of little monsters come run by and they just scatter the letters everywhere and you have to drag them back to the appropriate spot. You can still see the outline of the word. And then a little bug grabs the word and pulls back and you have a whole sentence. Monsters run by again and they scatter a couple other sight words.
Yeah.
And you have to put all the words together. And then once you've done that, then you get this cute little animation, the monsters, which is completely adorable, which is about kind of what the sentence said. So
sounds about like my level of Spanish. That's where I should start.
Maybe.
Yeah. Oh, you know, there's another app that I use called Learn Korean in a Month, I think it's called. And that is purely picture-based. And it was actually free, but it gives you sentences and then you identify the picture that corresponds with that sentence. And that is very challenging.
Cool.
But it's really, I think it's one of the best ways to learn is just like identifying sounds that you might not be familiar with and relating them to images that you see. So
If language is your jam and that's something that you want to learn, this is more of just sort of like a hack, but there's also many, many, many games, and this is obviously more prevalent in PC, but many games have been localized in many languages.
Right. Yes. Ah.
So you can just play any or most games or lots of games in just different languages if you just go into the settings and just change the language.
Right, yeah.
and then there's also captioning systems. So you can, in a lot, and this was sort of the juxtaposition of my Ignite talk too, but like if you can get the proper sort of combination of English subtitles and the foreign language actual content playing, then you can play that game and just sort of passively learn a language.
That's what I did with Assassin's Creed Unity, because for some reason they all had English accents, despite the fact that they're French.
How dare they?
I was offended. All right. My biggest problem with Unity.
So I hope that answers your question, Chuck, and thanks for sending it in.
Thanks,
we're
going
to wrap it up. Matthew, thanks so much for being here.
It was super fun. Thank you for inviting me.
That was awesome. So please subscribe to us on iTunes or RSS if you hate Apple. That's fine too. if you're on iTunes, please review us. Absolutely. That helps us out a lot. If you have questions, comments, or feedback, you can send those to hello@pixelkin.org. You can find us on Facebook, Pixelkin, and on Twitter at pixelkin_org, as well as Gaming with Moms. So don't forget about that Twitter account.
Send questions.
Yes, send questions. We like to answer questions. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back with you next week.
Bye.
This podcast was recorded in the studios of the Jack Straw Cultural Center in Seattle, Washington.